Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580, right here from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champain, this December 14th, 2008. The United States is a nation that is constantly reinventing itself, or at least the citizens of this country always are. It's one of our distinct attributes. Today we're going to be having, as our guest, a cultural studies expert and author, talking about the United States of Reinvention, Makeover Nation, his brand new book, a truly entertaining, provocative, and critical look at the United States. Our guest today, Toby Miller. But first, before we go to our guest, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
The next time you turn on cable TV and are clicking your way through countless reality shows, gruesome murder dramas, news shows with little actual news, household how-tos, and home shopping, consider this. Most of the hundreds of channels are owned by just a handful of companies. Up to now, programming giants like NBC Universal, News Corp, Time Warner, and Viacom have cluttered the system with their many networks by forcing cable systems to carry them. This is called wholesale bundling, or tying, and leaves little room for independent and minority programmers. On December 18th, the Federal Communications Commission will take up two cable items. The first is the complaint process for programmers who can't get their channels carried. Parul Desai, Associate Director of Media Access Project, explains that programmers have little leverage to use against cable companies when they are discriminated against for being unaffiliated with a big media company.
Well, the FCC has a carriage complaint process, but it hasn't really worked very well. Some of these complaints can sit for years before they get settled or get resolved, if they get resolved at all. But in the meantime, what happens is the programmer gets blackballed. So say they're trying to get on Comcast, they file a complaint against Comcast, and then Cablevision, Bright House, all these other companies find out about it and say, hey, we're just not going to deal with you. So they can get blackballed, they can get retaliated against, or they just go out of business waiting for the FCC to resolve the complaint.
The FCC will be voting on an order that will give some teeth to the complaint process. Media Access Project and others have proposed, among other things, a six-month shot clock to resolve complaints and arbitration through the FCC or an administrative law judge. The second piece of the agenda addresses wholesale unbundling. Desai explains.
For example, ESPN says, sure, we'll give you ESPN, but we want you to have ESPN Classic, ESPN 2, ESPN 3, ESPN 4. And the way they price it, the way they bundle it, the cable operator essentially has no choice but to take the whole bundle. And so what happens is that by tying all the popular programming with less popular programming, these programmers use their leverage to dominate the bandwidth, the capacity, and the channel positions on the cable systems.
FCC Chairman Kevin Martin is not calling for a final vote to end this practice, but for another period of public comment on ways to bring more diversity to cable programming.
11-year-old Michael Ibarra's grandmother says he is blessed with good brains. His intelligence and drive to succeed got him a scholarship to a private school in San Gabriel, California. Now, his grades are slipping. Margaret Ibarra says it's because he's not connected to the internet at home.
I couldn't afford it. I know we need it. I know he needs it desperately because, you know, his school, he goes to a private school, and I can get no emails or nothing. They think like I'm from the backwoods that I would. They have to call me or I have to call them, and it's a hassle, but I guess eventually, with him now going into seventh grade, we need it.
Most of Michael's homework and the school's administrative business come through the internet. He must rely on his friends, his time in study hall, and the goodwill of a kind neighbor. As a result, he doesn't always get his assignments in on time. Michael feels that he's being left behind academically and culturally.
Sometimes he gets angry because he's got to go to the neighbors to borrow them. Or to the library, there's room, because here, the library, you can get access to them, because there's kids like him, a lot of them don't have it.
Census Bureau statistics say that more than 40% of all U.S. homes are not connected to high-speed internet. Millions of young people are left with few opportunities to succeed in school and beyond. This past week, President-elect Barack Obama gave the unconnected some hope. He spoke about the need for a national broadband strategy during his weekly address.
Here in the country that invented the internet, every child should have the chance to get online. And they'll get that chance when I'm president, because that's how we'll strengthen America's competitiveness in the world.
And while Obama was talking about his broadband plans, hundreds of people gathered in Los Angeles to discuss ways to close the digital divide. InternetForEveryone.org, a broad-based initiative to connect everyone in America to a fast, open, and affordable internet, had its first interactive town hall meeting. After a series of hearings across the country, the results will be delivered to the Obama administration and Congress as a tangible plan of action. Change can't come soon enough for Michael Ibarra.
If I don't do my homework, then I'm not learning something new every day. I'll be missing out.
For more information about future town hall meetings, go to internetforeveryone.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580, right here from Campbell Hall in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today is the author of a brand new book, Makeover Nation, The United States of Reinvention, just published by Ohio State University Press. The author is none other than Toby Miller, a professor at the University of California, Riverside, and probably one of the most accomplished authors in the field of media studies and cultural studies of the past two decades. And he's joining us today from California to talk about his new book. Toby Miller, are you there? Yeah, hello, Toby.
Introduction.
Yeah, hi, Toby. How are you?
I'm very well, but I think you should really be speaking about yourself rather than me in terms of accomplished.
Well, flattery will get you everywhere, Toby, but let's flatter our listeners now and talk about your wonderful new book, Makeover Nation, if we can. First of all, why did you write this book? What was the reasoning behind it, and what's your main point you're trying to make with the book, if there is one?
Yeah, good questions. Why do we write books, Bob? It's a general one, isn't it, really? When you send books out into the academic stratosphere, of course, it's a very tiny stratosphere with a small number of readers. And sometimes you wonder, is there any point to this? Is there any value? I guess in terms of the general strategy of writing a book, you hope that it'll find a readership that is interested in discussing the ideas beyond the tiny cloisters that we occupy. So that's one reason for writing it. Another reason for writing this particular book is that I suddenly realized that, as you can tell from my voice, I spent my whole life in Brooklyn until I moved out to California. I suddenly realized that after 15 years of living in the United States, I felt as though it was time for me to make some kind of statement, not just about Hollywood or not just about sports, a couple of the topics that I'd focused on, but about what I saw as the country in general. That up till now, I'd really felt as though, look, you're lucky to be here, you're an immigrant, you should try to fit in as best you can, and don't be grandiose and claim to give Olympian Zeus-like narratives from on high about this country. And I suddenly thought, you know, damn it, I've been here a decade and a half, I've lived through this grotesque period of the Bush hegemony, and I want to say something. So that was why I wrote the book. In terms of what I was trying to get at, I wanted to address, and I guess I'm interested in your thoughts on this, the idea of the American dream, what it was, what it is, and what it might become.
You know, Toby, since you put it in the context of the fact that you, you know, come originally from both Britain and Australia, sort of like Rupert Murdoch, that you come as an outsider, you know, what, before we get into your book any further, what do you think most Americans are unaware of about how America is perceived by people outside the United States?
I think that's really a crucial issue. And one of the things I've been looking at is so-called anti-Americanism around the world. I think one of the things people don't recognize is that in many ways, our popular culture, our high-quality journalism, our high-quality music, some of our great movies, even some of our great TV shows, and some of our not-so-great bits of popular culture are actually our best calling card. The things that make people outside the U.S. dislike this country, and that have done so dramatically in the last 8 years, are not about sex and titillation in cinema. They're not about rap music and its supposed misogyny. They're not about what is seen as the triviality of reality TV. The things people don't like in this country are the fact that it has bases in military sites across the world, that it is likely to invade, bomb, or in some way commercially or governmentally manipulate almost any country in the third world at any moment, and specifically its policies and programs in the Middle East. And really, you know, when you look at almost every opinion poll conducted here, conducted around the world, it's our foreign policy and the interlocking interests of the military and major corporations of the United States that are the problem. The messages that we send out from popular culture, which are about transcendence and hope and becoming something more than you were born as, these are the things that people admire about America.
And your book is about that, about the makeover nation. But as you point out, it's not a book that's purely to praise or necessarily to damn, but rather to make a critical analysis of the makeover nation. And one of the things that was striking to me, Toby, as I read the book, was that this is not sort of a Tocquevillian sort of, this is in the American DNA. There's an element of that. But also you're arguing that this notion of the makeover has really gone to a different level in the past generation. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, and this is where I think there are some very negative aspects to the makeover. If you think about de Tocqueville and the way he loved what he saw as the flattened democratic nature of U.S. society, where participation was valued by all, of course, meaning white property-owning men, but participation by all was valued, and there was this loose network of massive numbers of civil associations, little societies of people grouping together to get done what they wanted, rather than traditional European-style societies that were top-down, that were monarchical, that had enormously strong centralized governments and that were militaristic in their inclinations. That model is not the one that I think really applies to this country today. Even though we see it invoked and admired constantly in self-admiring profiles of the nation in the media and elsewhere, rather what I think we now have is a comprehensively commodified and even governmentalized notion of civil society that's all about how you can reinvent yourself either through very organized, often extremely hierarchical and authoritarian religion, or you can reinvent yourself by the purchase and the use of various commodities, particularly corporate commodities. And the things that I'm focused on particularly in the book are this religious makeover, the makeover that comes from pharmacology, everything from Prozac to Ritalin, and also the idea that you can make over your physical body, not just in order to become a new person as per something beyond what you were born as, but in order simply to keep your job. And I'm interested in that, in particular in the way in which nowadays the requirement to look young, fit, lean, and beautiful and keep your gorgeous young body, such as you and I have managed to do, Bob, is something that male executives and even lower-level male managers are now called upon to do in ways that women have had to face up to for centuries.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Toby Miller, who you've just been listening to, a professor of cultural studies and media at the University of California at Riverside, the author of numerous books, including the book we're talking about right now on the program, his brand new book, Makeover Nation, The United States of Reinvention, published just a couple months ago by Ohio State University Press. If you'd like to call into WILL AM 580 with a question or comment for Toby Miller, the phone number here is 333-9455, our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. And, you know, one of the things you do in the beginning of the book, Toby Miller, that I thought was really instructive was that you go at great length through sort of the changes in this country's, for lack of a better term, political economy over the past 25, 30 years, really not just in the W. Bush years, but going back into the 1970s. And how this country has dramatically changed in ways that I think Americans sort of intuitively understand but haven't really come to terms with.
Yes, and I think we're actually seeing those very dynamically exhibited, unfortunately, in the tragedy of the last 3 or 4 months in terms of the collapse of finance capital and the collapse of manufacturing, represented by the situations of the banks and the auto manufacturers, respectively. What I'm trying to get at in those introductory remarks, Bob, to try to set a substrate for the book, is to say something's profoundly wrong in a country that has seen such a dramatic redistribution of wealth upwards over the last 30 years. It really starts with Carter. It gets worse under George Bush the First. It accelerates appallingly under Clinton and, of course, reaches its dreadful apogee under George Bush Minor, our current president. And how does that happen? It happens because of the slow, now fast decline of manufacturing and hence the middle-class aspirations of working people. It happens because of a series of changes in the tax codes, both at state and federal levels, that privilege people who are in senior executive positions. I mean, if you look back to when Lyndon Baines Johnson was president of the United States, the average CEO of a major corporation made about 24 times more than what the average worker at his or her, of course, always his firm made. Now, 40 years on, it's not 24 times, it's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times the money. And that redistribution of income upwards has occurred. Really, it's the first country, and Britain turns out to be the second, it's the first country that's ever gone in that direction, even after the extension of the electoral franchise to working class people, to women, to migrants, and so on. In almost every other case of an advanced democracy, when you extend that franchise electorally, you see a redistribution downwards of wealth. And even the power of neoliberalism and globalization over the last 30 years hasn't reversed those trends in places like Italy and Germany and Japan and so on, but it really has in the United States. And I feel as though the tragedy of that remarkable transformation that was achieved by really a ruling elite of economists, of intellectuals, of corporations, of politicians, of leading churches and so on over those decades, that's seen ordinary Americans work harder, earn less, contribute more, and frankly, in many ways, buy into a sort of notion that, well, I no longer am in a secure position financially, but at least I can have my fantasy structure, that I'm free in a way that no one else in the world is, and I'm free to become a new and different person. And so investments that might have been made in politics and in trying to reverse this redistribution of income are instead made into more and more and more connection to religion, more and more negative attitudes to migrants, and more investments in the whole edifice of psychiatry, psychology, and so on. And you can see it in the dramatic ways in which people are engaging in pharmacology, legal, licit pharmacology through doctors and so on to change their minds, to make them feel happier. And you can see it in the way in which each time, and this has happened over 150 years in the United States, there's a massive economic downturn. The corollary is an incredible increase in church attendance. People are looking for faith, they're looking for transcendence because they're not receiving it in their ordinary, everyday material lives.
Toby Miller, our guest today on Media Matters, author of the brand new book, Makeover Nation, The United States of Reinvention. You've been listening to Toby Miller talk just right now. He is a professor at the University of California at Riverside. This is a brand new book just published by Ohio State University Press. Let's talk, Toby Miller, if we can, a little bit more about religion and are you talking about all religion, Unitarians, Roman Catholics, Mormons, Buddhists? I mean, when you talk about religion as part of the Makeover Nation, what do you have in mind?
And that's a very good challenge, of course. I guess a lot of us tend, when we look at the influence of religion on politics especially, to extrapolate from the religious right and say that that is all of religion. And it's one of the things I, as a very secular atheistic person, have to be careful of in my own tendency to stereotype. It's less than a fifth of the U.S. population that affiliates in any sense with the religious right. Of course, they're very loud and they're very powerful because they're so crucial, particularly the white men among them, to the Republican Party's electoral base. And they're also very successful in a lot of their media activities. But they're, in fact, not a major majority. And by any means, as I said, only really about 18% of the population. And if you look at Protestantism, for the first time in 2005, in general, it ceased to be the dominant religion in the United States, to have a majority of people affiliating with it. We see, obviously, major differences between the Catholic Church and a lot of the Protestant churches, particularly the new evangelical ones, over issues of worker justice. The Catholic Church, for all that it adopts extremely negative attitudes, in my view, about women's right to choose and so on, and women priests, and also homosexuality, has extremely positive pro-worker positions on things like income, on things like union organization, and of course is in many cases opposed to the death penalty. So it's a very far cry from, you know, the sort of stereotyping of religion, no question about that. And similarly, many of the other faiths, for example, Judaism, extremely important in the United States and elsewhere in terms of its commitment to learning, intellectualism, and so on. But I think there is within the U.S. tradition, however splintered it may be, such a remarkable tendency to lurch towards religion at times of economic distress, and to lurch towards religion in a way that tends not to be the Catholic way of collectivity, but instead towards a very unforgiving Protestant notion of individual justice, individual injustice, and people getting their just desserts. That's almost like the really rather gruesome God of the Old Testament. And I say this as somebody, for what it's worth, who was sent to Anglican schools, admittedly by a communist mother and an agnostic lapsed pastor or father, and who therefore had to inculcate, admittedly not in the United States, a lot of religious positions. I wouldn't claim to be entirely outside them because they were delivered to me on a routine basis. And I certainly want to acknowledge that there are differences between religions that are extremely important, but the idea that if you're not a person of faith, you're not a legitimate person in the United States, and the way in which religious belief is so inculcated into people as a core value, such that it's impossible to imagine an agnostic, let alone an atheist, candidate for the presidency having any chance of winning at all, I find quite appalling, because the kind of religion that I was brought up to understand acknowledged that, you know, what was Caesar's, what was God's, and basically you kept church and state separate. Now it's become a litmus test for one's fitness for public office, and I frankly think that's appalling, just as I think it's appalling that the level of religious indoctrination in this country seems to take off and be so successful just at the level when just at the times when people need political economic indoctrination in their material interests instead.
Our guest, Toby Miller, you've been listening to, author of the brand new book, Makeover Nation, The United States of Reinvention. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, WILL AM 580. The phone lines here are open at 333-9455 and 1-800-222-9455. I'm going to go to the phone lines in a second, but before I do want to do a quick follow-up on your last comment, Toby. What role, I mean, the U.S. news media in specifically, but the entirety of the media in general, is accused by the religious right of being hostile to religion, of being atheistic and godless, or certainly, if not atheistic and godless, certainly not sympathetic to the spiritual values of fundamentalist Christianity or religion, and being sort of a corrosive force to those values in our society. In your analysis, does our news media providing sort of this counterbalance to the religion, to fundamentalist religion, in that manner, or is there another way to understand this relationship?
Yes, that's a very complex story, obviously, in that rather like religion, our news media are not one thing; they're many, many complicated things. And your pioneering work, both as a scholar and as an activist, Bob, have drawn the public's attention to that in remarkable ways. One of the issues that the religious right has managed to organize around very effectively is the claim that the mainstream news media, as they call them, the mainstream media or MM, are biased against conservatism and biased against religion. Now, almost every credible content analysis that's been done by academics, activists, and other independent researchers has shown that that is just rubbish. It's simply untrue. And in fact, if you look at Justin Lewis's pioneering work on U.S. public opinion, he shows that the public opinion on many, many, many topics in the U.S., from environmentalism through to same-sex marriage, is often way to the left of that of most journalists at the big corporations, and certainly to the left of the proprietors of the major media corporations. So You know, my personal view, and I think it's buttressed by a lot of the evidence, is that a core way to organize, to animate, to co-opt people in the religious right to become politically active is by basically telling them that they are being betrayed and the love of their country is being betrayed by an evil secular news media, regardless of the evidence. I mean, if you go back to the 1960s, quite sizable majorities of the U.S. public said that church and state must be kept separate. Now we have reasonably sizable majorities saying that, in fact, state policy should be made based on religious faith. There's a very dramatic change of about 15 to 20 points in public opinion on that issue. And it seems to me that a lot of that comes, on the one hand, because of the successful mobilization of the Christian right to argue that the media do not pay sufficient heed to questions of religiosity, but on the other hand, to the fact that in reality, the way the mainstream media covers religion is in some remarkable, elevated sense that this is the true guide to life. So I think there are sort of two contradictory things going on. People get animated and mobilized by the religious right by being told they're discriminated against by the mainstream media on the one hand. On the other hand, very contradictorily, the mainstream media cover religious influence in politics as if it were almost, can I use that word, holy.
Our guest, Toby Miller. This is Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney. Let's go to our phone lines now to our first caller who's been waiting very patiently. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air.
Hello, how are you? I would like you to comment upon something I noticed that started occurring roughly during the same period you're describing here, say the early 80s on, is the fact that many people in our nation spend rather enormous sums of money wearing the logos of corporations. You know, they buy designer this and designer that that has a name on it, and as an example, Harley-Davidson is one of them. People have the motorcycle, and they spend a lot of money on clothing and so on and so forth that so they can be seen as part of that group, and NASCAR is the same way, which strikes me as being a way of developing one's identity or going out and purchasing one's identity and establishing it by brand preference. Could you care to comment on that?
Thank you very much, caller. Toby?
That's a great question. I absolutely agree. There's an incredible irony, and I think the caller's probably onto this in his remark, in the fact that when Bob and I and perhaps the caller were younger, T-shirts in themselves, for example, were really quite radical symbols because, I think you'd concur with this, Bob, they were such a turn away from the button-down, starched white-collar look, right?
Correct.
And specifically, if you think about the 60s and especially the early 70s, writing on T-shirts as opposed to the all-white chesty Bonds look, writing on T-shirts sent a message that in and of itself, and often also in terms of what it said, was quite radical, was countercultural. It was often something that was associated not only with words but with images. And one thinks of Che Guevara or Muhammad Ali appearing on T-shirts, you know, Che in his beret. Has made a comeback recently, of course, as a symbol of countercultural alternatives to the mainstream. Now, the whole story of fashion, of course, is that frequently big corporations are not very good at inventing things or coming up with new ideas. Instead, what they like to do is listen to the street and watch the street. And so nowadays, there are a couple of things going on. One is, as the caller says, Harley-Davidson, NASCAR, and other major corporate entities want to put their brand onto these T-shirts and other items of apparel in order to brand the people who wear them. And also, of course, they want to engage in what's called viral marketing. Viral marketing uses this rather unpleasant metaphor of disease so that sometimes it's not that you have a Harley or a NASCAR event mentioned on your T-shirt, but rather there is something on your T-shirt that doesn't even clearly articulate directly to a brand, but instead leads people to that idea through some other cultural association. And then, of course, what happens is the people who were, and the equivalent of the people who were in the 60s and 70s, were wearing clothing that marked them out as having an identity in a way that wasn't about corporations governing your life, but was precisely the opposite. Anti-war, pro-feminism, pro-queer, pro-civil rights, whatever it may have been, suddenly that instead becomes a way of finding an identity utterly through the corporate world. And one example of this, slightly beyond clothing, is product placement, something that Bob's done work on in the past, I know. The way in which a lot of extremely musically appealing and fantastic rap songs, but people like Kanye West, 50 Cent, and so on, that I enjoy personally, nowadays, because of the concept of bling and the idea of wanting to refer to expensive commodities that you can buy and enjoy as part of the lifestyle represented in some of this music, nowadays those corporations, alcohol companies, food, fast food outlets, and so on, actually pay to have their products placed in the songs. So then you get a kind of reverse process, if you see what I mean, whereby what used to be a means of showing you had an alternative identity through the use of some commodity form now becomes a means, sometimes almost unconsciously, of subscribing to an identity that's handed down to you by a corporation.
Our guest, Toby Miller, author of Makeover Nation, The United States of Reinvention. Toby Miller is a professor at the University of California at Riverside. This is Media Matters and WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. My name's Bob McChesney, your host. The phone lines here are 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Please call in if you have any questions or comments. Toby, I want to get on to a lot of stuff in your book, but I do want to go a little further into religion for a second. I'm going to date myself here, but it was probably almost three decades ago. I read a book, I think, by Paul Thoreau. It might have been Naipaul. And he had a line in it that I thought of as I read your book, where he said, people adopt fundamentalist religion for the same reason they become drug addicts or use drugs, because they want to make themselves interesting to themselves. And I was wondering, you know, what is the appeal, in your view, of why in the United States compared to other countries of fundamentalist religion? I mean, what's going on there that really drives people in that direction?
Well, I think there are some historical answers to that, Bob. For example, if we go back and we look at Salem in the 17th century, you know, Salem and its census and all the evidence we have about church attendance, you're talking about four-fifths of people not regularly attending church at all. And this is supposed to be the crucible of Puritanism in this country. Today, it's inconceivable to think of the equivalent of Salem having 18% of people going to church on a routine basis. Something has changed. What is it? Well, if you, again, looking at our history, if you think about the horrors of slavery, principally black slavery, but of course there was also some slavery of white people as well, going back hundreds of years, religion, in different ways, offered succor. It offered support. It offered a way out. It offered a possibility of a better future. It offered a cultural haven. It offered a lingua franca amongst people who often came from different linguistic backgrounds. So I think religion can be very, very important for those who are downtrodden, criminalized, and racialized in this country, and it has done ever since. In addition, people who came here not against their will, not as slaves, but as voluntary migrants, say from Eastern and Central Europe, from Italy, from Germany, wherever it may have been, in the particularly the late 19th and early 20th centuries. They arrive here, they come to a country that is comprehensively plutocratic. This is the first Gilded Age. We're now living in the second one, although thankfully some of the gilt is falling off. I say thankfully in a slightly ironic way. They arrive here to the First Gilded Age to what is a comprehensive plutocracy, i.e. the rule of a society by the wealthy. There are very few state services available to them between the period of, say, 1880 and 1920, massive migration to this country, of course, for farming and manufacturing jobs. And it's churches that very, very successfully compete for their adherents. Churches provide opportunities for housing, for jobs, for meeting other people, for getting married, not just in the technical sense of a ceremony, but meeting people that you might wish to marry, and so on. So, you know, churches take the place in the United States of what were becoming strong central states in other major global economies of the time. So I think that's a very important element. Plus, because people were coming from such different linguistic backgrounds, they tended to move into, depending on which part of the country they ended up in, churches that, rather like the banking system, were extremely decentralized. You know, we still have literally thousands of different banks in this country. It's inconceivable to people from any other nation that this can happen. And in the same splintered way, we have literally thousands of different churches. The same thing applied to currency. You know, it's only 150 years ago that there were dozens of different currencies being used in the United States. It's, you know, your work in communications alerts us to the fact that the railway systems were barely compatible. The time zones in the early 19th century, you know, there were dozens of them across the Midwest and eventually on into the west coast of the country. There simply wasn't a nation in the sense that we understand it today. And instead, there were these often gigantic, often tiny networks of difference organized around commerce and especially around religion. So I think that's what set up the conditions of possibility. Now, having said that, obviously the country became somewhat more secular and became organized around the more conventional churches, especially Roman Catholicism, in the 20th century, up until the period after the 1960s. And there's something that goes on in the 60s, even at a time of great prosperity for many people, that sends, in particular, suburban, middle and lower middle class white folks into a kind of frenzy. It is the civil rights movement. It's the rebellions by African Americans in inner cities in the 60s. It's the collapse, it's so-called, of the conventional family, the hippie world, the alternative world, the events that we saw swirling around Chicago, not under your wonderful governor, Mr. Blagojevich, who, by the way, I think should be appointed to a chair at the University of Illinois in communications privacy. but instead, of course, the Richard Daley Sr. Version of Illinois life, what happens at the Democratic Convention in 68, the sense that the country is spiraling out of control, the emergence of a discourse of feminism, of gay rights in addition to civil rights, all these things seem to be unremittingly secular, unremittingly urban, and dangerous. And people look for an alternative. What alternative do they find? Well, if you look at the 1972 Republican convention, you find that throughout that 1972 election campaign, the Republicans, referring to the Democrats as the party of acid, abortion, and amnesty. Acid meaning LSD, abortion meaning pro-choice, and amnesty meaning amnesty for resistors to the draft to go to Vietnam and fight. And from that point on, you see a grand political bifurcation in this country, and this is where I'll stop in literally 30 seconds. More and more activists in the Democratic Party become secular, pro-feminist, pro-queer, pro-migrant. More and more activists in the Republican Party become anti-secular, anti-feminist, anti-queer, anti-migrant, and articulated around a popular base within religion.
Our guest, Toby Miller, who you've just been listening to here on Media Matters. The phone number for those who'd like to call in, again, 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Toby Miller is the author of the brand-new book, Makeover Nation, The United States of Reinvention. And we are going to go back to our phone lines right now. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air with Toby Miller.
Good afternoon. I love your comments, and I have always personally felt that the changeover from a secular, more alternative, a more relaxed society of the 60s and early 70s got more and more conservative as after Carter lost to Ronald Reagan. And it was almost as if the think tanks, the conservative think tanks, had decided that, you know, this has gone far enough. We must not have so much looseness. We must not have so much availability for change. We have to tighten up the way the way people think and act. You know, no more hippies, no more protests to the war, no more civil rights, no more all the things you mentioned, no more feminism. We really have to just make a 180-degree turn to get away from all of that. And I think that was when the Republican Party began its push for conservative judges, and the federal bench became quite filled with conservative Republican type judges. Anyway, I've said my piece. I would love to hear your comments.
Well, thank you very much, caller Toby Miller. Any particular comments on the caller's statement?
Well, I absolutely agree with her. There is a watershed with Carter. It's interesting, of course, in that Carter and Clinton are often described as the people who were able to win the presidency because they could win the South, but they were also evangelicals. And ironically, it's really the Democrats who say we can mobilize evangelical politics to our advantage. That was the idea with Carter. The problem was that Carter, for all the things that people like me might disagree with him about in terms of a lot of his foreign policies and so on, Carter didn't think that evangelicals should get boondoggles from the federal government. And one of the things that he did was to remove federal government subsidies from Christian schools, military academies, and so on. This was then picked up on very successfully by the Republican Party, especially in the South, as a sign that he was in fact secular, despite his own religious background. And, of course, he had a split with the Southern Baptists later on, as we're all familiar with, because of the way in which they went further to the right. But it was the Democrats tried to mobilize evangelism without realizing quite how, as the caller so appositely put it, evangelical Christianity was moving further and further against ideas of the counterculture. Now, that said, I think another point she made is extremely important. It's very easy for us, particularly people in the mainstream media, when talking about evangelical Christianity, to endow it with a populist quality, to argue that it is a reflection, an index of what real Americans, and no offense to the people of beautiful downtown Champaign and Urbana, but real Americans are deemed to be in the I states. They're not deemed to be in Los Angeles and New York. They're in Indiana, Idaho, Illinois, and so on. This is the real America in the center of the country.
Yeah, that's us.
That's you guys. I am a sort of limp-wristed pinko guy swanning around in the Pacific Ocean. In fact, I'm bobbing up and down in it now. You're the real Americans. You're the real people. And it is alleged that you are the people who, in fact, are ignored by the continental elites. Now, the problem with that is it's the think tanks, as she so rightly said. They've been described by one or two people, I think, appositely as coin-operated think tanks. It's the think tanks like the American Enterprise Institute, the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, and there are dozens of others that have very, very, very successfully adopted positions that then evangelical churches pick up on. It's not that the think tanks are reflecting what ordinary people in the I states and others are saying. It's that I state people and others who subscribe to evangelical positions, often when it comes to political mobilization, are essentially given, I won't call them instructions, but are certainly given ideological perspectives by their priests, as it were, by their pastors, that come from think tanks that are located, you know, frankly, in the centers of power, like New York and D.C. and so forth. So there's no doubt that that's true. And there's no doubt that she's also right, this is my last point, in her comment about judges. This is one of the areas where, and this is something I try to get at in the book, the right learnt about the politics of spectacle from the left and then trumped the left. Right? The left had always said, okay, we didn't win the election in 68. Bobby was shot. Martin Luther King was shot. There were all these disasters. But what we'll do instead is become librarians, become teachers, become professors, and we'll get our points across in those areas. The right looked at this and thought, I don't like this very much. Similarly, civil rights attorneys and others within the legal infrastructure worked out that given that politics was not relevant to working class people, it instead tort areas and other parts of the law would be the domains where there would be an attempt to get redress and a fair interests of working people. So what the right then did was to respond to this politics of the spectacle by setting up its own politics of identity and spectacle, and of course by trying to change the way education operated in order to make it more religious and less secular, get away from that infiltration by the left, and especially get away from the American Bar Association's very important historic role in the selection of federal judges and others, and instead bring in the Federal Society and others who would be essentially ideological vanguards for the new right, ensuring that you got benches, especially federal benches, that were not positively inclined towards attempts at things like income redistribution, health care, and so on for working people.
Our guest, Toby Miller, who you've just been listening to, is professor at the University of California at Riverside and author of the brand new book, Makeover Nation, The United States of Reinvention, just published by Ohio State University Press. There's so much in this book, Toby Miller, that I want to cover, so I'm going to try to allow you to touch on some of the key points in the book in the remaining 12 or 13 minutes of the program. First of all, you talk a lot about religion in the book, but you also, as you've mentioned, talk about pharmaceuticals and drugs and their emergence as part of the makeover nation. And I was really struck by this as I read it. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, what has been going on in the last three decades, not just with illegal drugs, which people oftentimes talk about in this context, but with legal drugs?
Oh, absolutely. And it's really with legal drugs that I'm most concerned in the book, and in particular Ritalin, and the way in which Ritalin and other forms of methylphenidate, the drug that it is the commercial name for, are used to deal with people who are deemed to suffer from attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and its various cousins and so on. What we've seen in the last two or three decades is a comprehensive drugging of the American public, often done with the agreement of members of the American public, of course, often no doubt with extremely positive effects, frequently in ways that improve people's lives. I don't want for a second, for instance, to say that necessarily ADHD is invented. I don't want to say that mental illness and suffering are invented, not for a moment. But it's very clear that as we've seen a growth in the size and power of the pharmaceutical industry, we've seen a decrease in the amount of federal government oversight of that industry. We've seen more and more and more resources going not towards dealing with very major illnesses around the world, but also in the U.S., that one would always hope new inventions would be moving towards solving, but instead towards marketing, that the big pharmaceutical companies, which traditionally, along with the federal government, devoted vast amounts of their resources to research and development to try to deal with illness, now dedicate vast amounts of their resources to marketing, to merchandising. If the chemists come up with some new compound, the issue immediately is to get marketers in on the floor to find a potential name for a new malady that may not at this moment exist, as it were, that can be treated or changed by the new compound. And at the same time, we've seen the United States as almost the only country in the first world that allows direct-to-consumer advertising by pharmaceutical companies. This has resulted in massive pressure on GPs and others to prescribe drugs. And, okay, you can say it's an elitist perspective to argue that there shouldn't be so much direct-to-consumer marketing, but GPs find it very difficult now to turn down the demands of people for drugs. And frankly, there is room for elitism in the world. People like you and me, Bob, shouldn't be the ones who decide whether or not a bridge is safe for people to walk over. That's what engineers should be charged with doing. And often it's the same with other kinds of activity that require expertise. It's not elitist for me to argue that I should not be allowed to pilot a 747. I just shouldn't. I don't have the knowledge. So the direct-to-consumer marketing has seen massive increases in the uptake of a lot of mind-altering pills by members of the public. Again, we're seeing corporations picking up on what you said a moment ago, recognizing that there is a huge array of people of our generation, of 10 years older and 15 to 20 years younger, who associate alternative lifestyles with illegal drugs. You can now market legal drugs to just those people and say, hey, now you can take this pill. It'll make you feel more confident. It'll make you happier. And what's more, it's not illegal. You can get a steady supply of it. Just swallow and stop talking, stop undergoing therapy, stop being part of the Freudian disease, and join our method of reinventing yourself as a new American.
Now, to play the devil's advocate here, what's wrong with that? Why not have a nation where everyone can get pharmaceuticals to sort of figure out all their maladies and they go through life blissfully happy?
Well, I stand testament to that in that, you know, whenever I have to give a lecture, I feel miserable and unhappy, and I wish that I didn't have to do it. And if I could take a pill, a happy pill, that might be very good. No, there are all kinds of reasons, as I indicated at the beginning, why one should be able to take medication to help deal with problems one has. There comes a very interesting ethical question, and that is the difference between treating a very significant malady and engaging in what is called enhancement. And this is one of the areas where, to give Bush's henchpeople credit, his bioethics advisors, some of whom are very right-wing, have actually had some interesting philosophical debates. Let me give you a real-world example and get your view on this, Bob. If people at Yale Medical School say that they suffer from ADHD and therefore they should be given more time to do their exams, should they, in fact, get more time? Well, the federal courts say no on the grounds that, well, you're already a smarty pants or you wouldn't have gotten into Yale Medical School. So you've overcome your disability. Any additional service to you or more time for you to complete the exam would be enhancement. It would give you an advantage rather than simply getting you back to the start line at the same time as everybody else. Conversely, the NCAA, the National Collegiate Athletic Association, says that amongst drugs that athletes may take are Ritalin and other drugs that are associated with treating mental conditions. But if you were taking amphetamines, which are not very far away at all from Ritalin, then they would be regarded either as recreational or performance-enhancing drugs, and you'd be in trouble. So I guess what I'm saying is there are very complicated dividing lines between taking drugs in order to give you the same start in life as everybody else, the same capacity to deal with the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, versus the idea of I will simply transform myself and become a different person in ways that give me an advantage over everybody else. And this becomes particularly difficult and complicated with the area of biotechnology as applied to people who are not yet born, who are not yet people, where the mixture of things that make for a successful and happy life, which are obviously genes, society, parenting, individuality, luck, and industry, all of those get overrun, potentially overdetermined, by the decision in utero to alter the genetic composition of people and push them in certain directions. And that leads to all kinds of enormously complicated ethical questions that are far beyond the notion of simply, I'm unhappy, I'd like to be happy, give me a pill.
Toby Miller, our guest. We've only got a few minutes left today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. And Toby, there's one other really interesting part of this book. There's lots of interesting parts, but one I definitely want to get to before we end the program today, and one you alluded to at the top of the program, which is, you know, one of the ironies or tragedies, I think is even a better way to put it, that you chronicle in your book and you've looked at in your research is how the feminist movement, much of it was fueled by a desire to stop the objectification of women's bodies and having women be obsessed with their physical appearance and to make women have a relationship with their body closer to what men at that time had, where there wasn't the same obsession with how they looked. There was more of an obsession with what they were made of and what their characters were by comparison. And then ironically today, as you talk about, women are still, if anything, in a worse scenario in many respects in terms of how the culture deal with their appearance. But men, instead of having women move to the male position, men have been increasingly pushed to the female position of being obsessed about their physical appearance. And talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Yes, that's absolutely right. There is this extraordinary irony where for God knows how many centuries and God knows in how many societies, men's desire for women is allowable, legitimate, and even valued, no matter how critical it may be of the way women look, no matter how obsessed it may be with their sexuality, no matter how irrelevant it may consider questions of their intellect, their accomplishments, their education, their kindness, their lovingness, and so forth, that along come extraordinary achievements of feminism to criticize that. But just before we've drawn breath, suddenly we find that men are put under the microscope in terms of their body shapes, their body types. We have corporations, and this is before the current crisis, laying people off, laying men off, because they're deemed not to have the right look in order to sell the product that they're meant to represent. We have extraordinary increases in the sale of men's hair dye, basically to men in their 40s and 50s, because of the number of studies that, of course, are promulgated by major hair care companies like Clairol that say that men who have plenty of hair and whose hair is black or blonde or brown are regarded as more virile, more sporting, more intelligent, and more male than men who have little or no hair, thinning hair, or gray or silver hair. We see an extraordinary increase, Psychology Today, a popular magazine you can see on your newsstand, if you live anywhere that has a newsstand, that's been surveying men's attitudes to their bodies on a routine basis since the early 70s. We find levels of male dissatisfaction with their body type increasing at bizarre levels. Men now are accelerating faster than women in terms of their experience of eating disorders. Women still have more eating disorders in toto, but the increase amongst men is much faster, whereas women still take up well over three-quarters of plastic cosmetic surgery clients or patients in the United States. Men are increasingly undertaking cosmetic surgery. Some of this is presumably about personal desire, narcissism, whatever you want to call it, but some of it, as is the case with women, is that this has become a necessary part of the calling card of the currency of gender, that men can't survive if they don't look the right way anymore.
Toby Miller, our guest. Toby, we've only got a handful of seconds before we have to wrap up today, but real quickly, you say in the book you want people to question Makeover Nation, and you certainly do that in your book. Once we've questioned it, what next?
Well, I think we try to look at the good sides of the American dream, the sides of the American dream that say it doesn't matter what you were born as in terms of race or gender or class or sexuality or religion, you can become something new. We take that, we see how it's inspired people who grew up here, like you, people who came here, like me, and people who've never been to the United States, and we say, how can we disinter that from a purely commodity-driven notion of corporations and religions deciding who we are and what we can be?
On that note, I want to thank Toby Miller for being my guest today in Media Matters. Toby, thanks so much, and good luck with the book.
Thank you, Bob.
And I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer, and Kyle Kroha, our engineer, for working the board today. I'm Bob McChesney. This is WILL AM 580. We'll be back in 167 hours with our next edition of Media Matters. Have a great week, everyone.
Broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
Today in Champaign-Urbana, periods of rain throughout the day with a high of 52, wind from the south at 15 to 30 miles per hour with gusts to 40 miles per hour. Tonight, rain turning to freezing rain and snow overnight, a tenth of an inch of ice followed by an inch of snow accumulation. The low 22 degrees with winds from the southwest at 15 to 30 miles per hour, gusting to 40 miles per hour. You're listening to WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3, Urbana.